entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
In 64, Bob Bondurant drove a Shelby Daytona Coupe across a finish line in France and changed history. For the first time in many years, the GT category of the 24 Hours of Le Mans had not been won by a car that carried the iconic mark of the Black Stallion. The kingdom of Enzo Ferrari would never be the same. Carroll Shelby's team had done far more than win a battle against the Italian juggernaut. They were now within striking distance of winning a war and claiming the grandest prize of all. Le Mans was one of 20 races in the World Manufacturers GT Championship. The prestige and bragging rights that came with the title would yield untold millions in new car sales for Shelby's engine manufacturer and sponsor, the Ford Motor Company. For the Shelby American team, the stakes had never been higher. Then it all came crashing down.
As they approached the end of the season, there were three races left. And the Cobra team, if they won two of the three races, would win the championship. One race was 95% sure that the Cobras would win at Bridgehampton in the United States. The second race was 95% sure the Cobras would lose. That's a Tour de France in France. And the third race was probably a 75 or 80% chance that the Cobras would win at Monza, Italy. Monza was the big race.
They had the team together, they had the, you know, all the crew ready to go. So it was really theirs for the win for 64.
And then came the cancellation at Monza, and it changed everything.
The stakes are high, and the world's best are here to win.
We were 1 point behind for the last race of the season, which was at Monza. We had the six cars ready to kick the heck out of Ferrari, and what happened? Politics again. He had the automobile club in Monza call the race off.
They did not have the chance to run at Monza. There were no points available at Monza, and that cost them the championship in 1964.
Carroll Shelby set the tone with a bold statement that put the racing world on the edge of its seat. Driven by a red-hot desire for a rematch, the team set their sights on giving the coupe more speed and improved handling. With back-to-back wins at Daytona and Sebring, the team appeared unstoppable. But the series would now move to Europe, where the world's most challenging courses would test drivers and crews to their limits. It was the sacred proving ground of motorsports and the home turf of Ferrari. With a heavy workload of other Ford projects keeping Carroll Shelby tied down in the U.S., control of the team was handed to Ford's highly successful European rally manager, Alan Mann. Mann would be using champion British drivers Jack Sears and Sir John Whitmore, along with two more coming from Shelby, Bob Bondurant and Alan Grant. Shelby designated Bondurant to be the team's lead driver. But after landing at Heathrow, Bondurant learned that Mann had other plans.
He met me and said, before you pick up your luggage, you may want to listen to me. I said, fine. And he said, I have the two best English drivers. They are fantastic, and they're number one and number two. If you wish to stay, you'd be number three, but you may want to run back to Carroll Shelby. I thought, that just pissed me off.
Alan Mann had a totally different way of running a team than Carroll Shelby did. Mann had already been, for years, using staged finishes, 1-2 finishes, or dead heats, and he had designated people in the English system who were supposed to lead the race, and those who were supposed to not lead the race.
It was like this. I'm really racing against my English teammates as well as Ferrari, and his drivers were very good drivers.
Ironically, the first test of this uneasy alliance would begin where the team's hopes were crushed in 64, Monza. Despite out-qualifying the field, Bondurant was still ordered by Mann to run 500 yards behind the Englishman. When the American went out too fast, Mann had the pit crew signal him to slow down.
They're leaning over, slow down, slow down. And I thought, okay. So I downshifted from fourth into third gear, went by, slow. And then out of sight, I was on it, flat out. Come by again, did that 10 times. I thought, you know, screw this, just stand out and go for it. At the end, we won, and we're gonna get together for dinner, met in the bar. And Jack Sears came up to me and said, how come you didn't wait for us? I said, I beg your pardon, Jack? Wait for you? I said, Jack, I don't know how you race in England. But in America, we race to win, and that's what I'm doing.
Bondurant continued to lead the team in victories, defying Mann and irritating his English teammates. While Enzo Ferrari's mighty GTOs enjoyed sporadic wins, the majority of points were going to the Daytona Coupes. Motorsports fans were thrilled to get two major rivalries in a single season. What started out as the Americans versus the Italians had become the Americans versus the British. It was the Revolutionary War all over again, and the deciding race was about to take place on the most fitting date possible. Reims was a 12-hour endurance race on a 5-mile course in a land where ancient kings were crowned. With the Shelby American team far ahead in points, a win here would secure the championship. Alan Mann, stinging from mechanical failures at Le Mans just days ago, demanded that Bondurant and co-driver Joe Schlescher run 1,000 yards behind Sears and Whitmore, who wouldn't go any faster than needed for the GT win. The team's internal struggle reached a boiling point. This time, it was Schlescher who defied Mann and passed his English teammate.
Joe Schlescher was old school driver where you went all out and did the very best you could. And this was something new for Joe Schlescher, just like it was for Bob Bondurant. And here he was being told to follow a fairly slow car, the English-driven Cobra Daytona Coupe. And so Joe Schlescher didn't do that. Alan Mann gave him a pit signal to come in, stop the car, and get out, whereupon Alan Mann told Joe Schlescher that if you don't do what I say and follow the English Daytona Coupe, then I'm going to pull you out of the car and put another driver in. Joe Schlescher's wife then took, according to Alan Mann, a glass of champagne and threw it in Alan Mann's face.
She wanted Joe to win as well. I mean, it was he was a great driver as well. He'd been driving Cobras a long time. He wanted to win the race. Same as Bob did, and same as Whitmore did. They all wanted to win the race, but, you know, unfortunately, there's only one winner.
During the night, Jack Sears blew a rod and limped into the pits. All the Ferrari GTOs had been retired with breakdowns, giving Bondurant and Schlescher a clear shot at the win. Thanks to heroics by the team mechanics, the Sears-Whitmore coupe was resurrected in time to join Bondurant for a photo finish. At 11 a.m. on Independence Day, another king was crowned in Reims.
Coming around on that last lap at Reims, is the 4th of July, and got the checkered flag first, so we won. On the 4th of July, beat the Brits and beat Ferrari. It's like, wow, this is fantastic. I was so happy. And Joe Schlescher was too. We gave each other a hug. And by the way, Reims is the capital of Champagne. So we celebrated with champagne, heartily.
For the first time in history, an American team had won the World Manufacturers GT Championship. Some might say it happened despite the team's internal strife, but perhaps it was because of it. Maybe Alan Mann gave Bob Bondurant more desire, while Bob gave Alan and Ford much more than the victory they'd asked for. Together, they reminded us that underdogs can win. And something else, that nothing extraordinary in this world comes without one hell of a fight.
Robert, this is Kel Shelby. I told you that I would do your program next Wednesday, but I have to test the 1,000 horsepower Mustang all day Wednesday. I'll talk to you in the meantime. This is Friday after mass. I'm just trying to call you back. Take care.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers and Google Tantalk1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com. We can find out all about us. And if you've missed any of our past shows, don't forget to check out NostalgicRadioandCars.com. That's where all our shows are. And you can share that with the whole wide world. Anyway, we got a great show for you tonight. We got a very special guest coming on. A little bit of a clue with this narrative that we had up here a few minutes ago. And but I'm going to go into a couple of announcements here real quick. Definitely, if you want to find out where all the car shows are in the state of Florida, check out flacarshows.com. But also this weekend at the World Equestrian Center in Ocala, Festivals of Speed is having one of their events, and it's Saturday. So check out festivalsofspeed.com, and you can hang out with the rest of us up there at Festivals of Speed up at the World Equestrian Center. It's a mighty, mighty nice place. Bring your best sweetie with you, because it's a stunning place and the food's great and the atmosphere is going to be a lot of fun as well. Anyway, on that note, I think Ed's going to go ahead and fire up the stereo, and we got a really, really good conversation coming up here in a few minutes. So Ed's going to fire up the stereo, we're going to play a little music, we're going to get our guests on the phone, and as they say, buckle up, sit down, buckle up, and strap on a helmet, and let's go for a ride. You're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, don't touch that dial, we'll be right back.
You're on a one-way street. You crowd your clothes, spin your wheels, then you're gonna know how it feels to spin out, yeah, spin out. Better watch those curves, never let her steer. If she can shake your nerves, boy, then she can strip your gears. She'll get your heart going fast, then she'll let you run out of gas. So spin out, yeah, spin out. The road to love is full of danger signs. Too many guys were lost who crossed those double lines. Don't you know she's out to prove she can really score. Never saw parts move or like that before. To flag you down, that's a goal. Scoot before you lose control. Spin out, yeah. Spin out. She's at the groove. She can really score. Never saw parts move like that before.
Hi, I'm Bob Bondurant. I won the World Manufacturers Championship in Ford Cobras in 1965. And you're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening the widow of the late, great world champion, Bob Bondurant. I'm delighted to welcome to our show this evening, Pat Bondurant. Pat, how are you this evening?
I am excellent. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. So you're in sunny Arizona, nice and dry.
A little hot.
A little hot, yeah, it's okay. Well, it gets hot here in Florida, too, but at least, we sweat. You don't get a chance to sweat because it evaporates right away.
We have a dry heat here.
I always used to tell people, I said, Florida's a steam bath, and California and Arizona and New Mexico and Texas is all a sauna. Fair statement?
There you go. That's a fair statement.
So anyway, so let's talk a little bit about you. And then we'll get into the legendary Bob Bondurant. So give us a little background on yourself here a little bit so people know who you are.
Oh, well, obviously I married Bob Bondurant in 2010. We got married on the Bondurant school track first, so we had a legal marriage license. Then we flew across the pond and got married in Monaco on the Formula One track during the Formula One weekend. Yeah, who does that, right?
Well, that's pretty amazing, yeah.
Yeah, but no, I Southern girl, born in the middle of five brothers. I like to tell people I was raised by wolves.
Raised by wolves, okay.
There's no question about that. Of course, I became a car girl. How could you not with that many brothers? And, you know, I was actually a, I did Ford commercials and I did runway modeling and I was headed fashion design school. And my dad says, hey, NASA's hiring draftsmen for the summer. And I'm like, Daddy, I have to lay out by the pool, you know, before college. Well, long story short, NASA hired me. I became a draftsman on the first space shuttle. Eventually stayed in all male-dominated industries from that point on. Went from there to Boeing. My life has been absolutely crazy. I went into architecture. My first building was the Tomahawk Cruise Missile Facility. I'm not kidding you.
Really?
Then I started my own architectural firm, and I won national design awards on the world's first two-story fitness center, which everybody said they'll never fill them up. Well, look at where they are now. So, I mean, I just kept jumping from one male-dominated industry into the other, and as fate would have it, I met Bob Bondurant. And now I'm in another male-dominated industry, which was the racing school.
Racing school.
Bob Bondurant School of High Performance Driving.
Well, we have to back up for a second here because I want to go back to Memphis, where you're from. And I played Spin Out, which was performed by Elvis. So there's an Elvis connection. And for our listeners, tell us about your connection with the king himself, Elvis Presley.
Well, I was a St. Patrick's Day baby born in 1955. And Elvis Presley was an upcoming star. And he was very, very, very close friends with my own extremely good-looking father, who was a young lieutenant on the Memphis Police Force. So when you hear stories about Elvis riding around in a police car and he was fascination with police, that was my dad. So we had Elvis in our house all the time. We kids thought he was a nuisance. He would come in the front door, slide on the wood floor, reach up, turn the TV channel, and change our cartoons. We would scream. It would be pandemonium, messing up his hair in a big huddle of six kids and Elvis in the floor laughing and screaming and giggling. And we didn't know he was famous. You know, the guy came over to the house. He always bought us presents. But what was annoying as a kid is he'd go in the backyard with his guitar and sing church songs. And we're like, oh, God. But, you know, I was five when we moved from Memphis. But then when I was 13, we're going down the street in Memphis on a visit, and there's Elvis in a black limo. And he yells, he goes, Al, it's me, Elvis. This would be like 1971. And I rolled the window down, and he goes, hi, Patsy. And I just, wow. I absolutely love that man. And I'm going to tell you a little secret about Elvis. I don't care what photo or what movie he's in. You will never comprehend the magnetism of those eyes unless you saw them in person. Gorgeous.
Interesting.
Gorgeous.
Sounds like you had a secret what's that word they call it? Secret attraction. There's another.
Well, he was a dark blonde, and he would bring his black hair dye over to my mom to dye his hair in the kitchen sink.
Really?
And I'm sitting on the edge of the sink one day, and I'm pouting. My arms are on my chest, and I've got my bottom lip out. And he goes, baby girl, what is wrong with you? And I said, Elvis, mama won't dye my...
You there? Hello? Ed, see if you can call her back real quick, because I think...
Oh, no, here you go,
Are you back?
Go.
Okay.
So, sorry about that.
No worries.
So anyway, Elvis goes, why are you pouting, you know, baby girl? And I said, Elvis, mama won't dye my hair black like yours. And he goes, why do you want... Now, I was a blonde towhead. He goes, why do you want black hair? And I said, Elvis, you won't marry me if I don't have black hair. I was 5 years old, and he says, baby girl, keep that blonde hair. I think you're going to really like it when you get older. And good advice, Elvis. Well, I've been a blonde my whole life.
Well, now, okay, so I think you said you relocated to Huntsville, Alabama, there for a while.
Yeah.
Tell us what's going on in Huntsville. What was the big deal there?
Well, my mom graduated from high school at 13, super genius. Got transferred to Redstone Arsenal from, at the time, Memphis had a Navy base. So she gets transferred there, eventually climbs up the ladder, and is a GS-15, which is the highest-ranking civilian position there is in the government. She had offices in the Pentagon and in Huntsville, where all the engineering for all the missiles and everything you could think of for defense, all the engineering was done right there in Huntsville. So we moved to Huntsville, and first in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and then on into Memphis. I mean into Huntsville. Sorry.
Okay.
And then therefore, IE is how I ended up going to Bama.
Okay. That's the college you...
University of Alabama. My apologies.
Okay, no.
Bear Bryant.
Okay.
Ooh, yeah. Roll Tide.
Roll Tide.
That's all I got to say.
All right. So then... The draftsman job, so you took drafting in school, and then there was an opportunity to work at NASA then?
Yeah, on the first space shuttle. See, in order for me to go to fashion design school in Atlanta, you had to, it was recommended that you take a drafting course.
Okay.
So my senior year in high school, I took drafting, and NASA was hiring draftsmen for the summer jobs, and I apparently had a flawless pencil on Mylar, and my lettering literally looked like it came out of a typewriter. It was so perfect. So I just kept getting more and more raises to not go off to school in Atlanta and stayed there in Huntsville and continued till we got the shuttle up.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were drafting, what components were you working on for the space shuttle?
Started off on the structural test stand, which we did the shaker test on the shuttle.
Uh-huh.
And then, but I worked on the nose cone, the payload, the solid rocket boosters, the external tank, the robotic arm fixtures and fasteners. And the coolest thing I did was work on where it's not cool, but it's funny. An astronaut, in order to go to the bathroom on the shuttle, has to back himself up against the wall and lock in to these mechanisms and pull his arms through his suit and do his business. And I remember laughing when my boss said, "You're going to get to do the men's restroom." And I'm like, "What?" So, you know, it was fun. I remember the head of NASA coming to visit us in Huntsville. And he said, "Does anybody in here have any questions about what you're working on?" And I raised my hand. I'm 19 years old at this point. And he goes, "Yeah, little lady over there." And remember, this is the South. There's 4,000 men and maybe a handful of women. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Where are we putting weapons for the astronauts?" And you could hear a pin drop. And he goes, "Why would you come up with that question?" And I says, "Because everybody's seen Lost in Space."
Okay.
You have to be our age to understand the humor.
Yes.
But apparently that never happened.
Oh, so. You mean there was no Dr. Zachary Smith either on the stowaway?
No. And as you can tell already, I've had a very colorful life.
Yeah.
And I'm a very inquisitive person, so I ask questions.
So you spent some time in Florida too there. So tell us about that, because you were what was that? There was a program you were working on there about the rocket retrieval, and you were
when the solid boosters drop from the external tank and the shuttle gets to go into the atmosphere, it drops the solid rocket boosters in the external tank into the ocean.
Okay.
So we have to go out in the ocean with a ship and retrieve those parts. We bring them back to the basin there at Cape Canaveral, and then we 18-wheeler them back to Huntsville, Alabama, refurbish them, and then trailer them back to Cape Canaveral, and then we just kept recycling the solid rocket boosters. So I had a myriad of projects that I got to be involved in with United Technologies. And so anyway, that was one of the things we did, was carve out a basin so that we could bring the retrieval ship and bring the solid rocket boosters around. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun working in Florida. Every night when we got off work, the security guard would take a 6-foot pole and walk me out to my car, and he would swipe underneath the car for alligators.
Really?
And I'm like, wow, I have the craziest life. And then I have to have a guard bring me out to make sure there's not an alligator under my car.
That's interesting. Did you have any connections with the University of Central Florida back then? Because they were kind of...
I did not. They were very involved, yeah.
They were? Okay. So then, after you left NASA, is this when the television thing came about? Or
Nope. I'd been doing Ford commercials prior to that, but when they laid 4,000 of us off, we all went in different directions. And my old boss at NASA, he was the head of facilities. He, too, had to have another job, so United Technologies hired him. Huntsville has it's the highest income per capita in the nation, little-known secret to a lot of people, because
really?
Most of the Fortune 100 defense firms are located right there in Huntsville. And he was the facilities manager for United Technologies. He calls me up. I'm in Wichita, Kansas. And he says, hey, what do you think about coming back here and working in facilities? And I'm like, I'm in aerospace, Al. That'll never work. And he goes, no. He goes, you're a fantastic draftsman. You're sharp as hell. I'd like to bring you in as a protege. Long story short, I picked up architecture as if I'd done it my whole life. And eventually he turned over the Tomahawk cruise missile facility design to me.
Ooh.
And that's my first building. And then I bought my first 1966 Jaguar XKE, and that's on the rendering of the Tomahawk cruise missile building.
Really?
And I made a lot of money. I made a lot of money being a smart kid. And, I just kept walking into one door would close and another one would open. So then I started my own architectural firm. And when I had the architectural firm, that's when I won the National Design Awards. And, you know, my mom was so high up as a woman in a man's world that I was never taught there was a glass ceiling. And where I know a lot of my friends were like, oh, no, I could never do that. And I'm like, why not? So that was kind of, and I'm going to repeat, born in the middle of five brothers. You are not smart enough. You're not fast enough. You can't climb that tree. You can't swim in that creek. I mean, it's everything you can't do because it's all a world of being competitive with five brothers. So what did I do? I learned to be the best at everything. Captain of the basketball team, captain of the tennis team, state champion in archery. I mean, to my point to anybody in life is go do what you love. And if you don't even know if you love it yet, go try it. Like go into a pie tasting contest at the fair. Go try all the pies and see which one you like the best.
Well, I have to tell you that, you know, just talking to your sound, your voice and everything, your inflection, is totally inspirational. And it's like there are no boundaries. And I've got to hand it to you because people like you are the people, you know how I always tell you when you're in school, if you're a C student, you want to be an A student, hang around B and A students. If you want to be a flunky, hang around D and C. So you're the kind of person that I would want to hang out to because you see no boundaries. There's no ceiling. There's no cap. Anything is possible. And I admire that for you. That's amazing.
Thank you. I didn't plan it. It's just how my life unfolded. It wasn't something I set out to do. A lot of it was necessity. I need a job, What are you going to do next? I'll go find out.
Well, but the thing is it was almost like an adventure. And, and your enthusiasm, it's like it's instinctive. And you're driven. Okay, that's probably the best way to describe that. All right, so then after the architectural, now this is all, so the architectural thing is all in the business. That's in Huntsville, Alabama as well?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Okay, and then and then the TV thing, how did that come about in the commercials and stuff?
Well, then I came out to the West Coast, to Seattle. I was hired by the 8th largest engineering firm out of Ohio. And was doing project management. I did project management for them at DuPont in Nashville and some other large corporations and got pulled out to Bellevue, Washington and I had some big project management jobs there. One of my favorite was the robotic paint booth for the 747 wings.
Oh.
So that was a great story, but finished that, and, you know, there's some bad relationships in there, some bad marriages.
Well, we won't talk about that. We're going to talk about the good stuff.
Don't go there. But you know what? You've got to have, the bitter with the sweet.
Okay.
Why come to Earth if it's not going to be challenging, right?
Absolutely.
And so I took it all, you know. Took it all. But anyway, back to the TV station. You know, I was in Bellevue, and unfortunately, I started getting a severe mold allergy, and they moved me to the desert, and I was bored, and so I started a TV station, and a lot of fun. I had it for 14 years, so that when you open the show with Bob talking about the world championship race, I produced that.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I love the TV world. I've been in front of the camera, and I've been behind the camera. I've done documentaries. I've interviewed. Yeah, you know, it was. In other words, I'm not an introvert.
Okay, I have to ask you real quick on the production. It referenced Red Guitar as one of the production.
My favorite company to hire. Chris, the owner, has the most amazing voice.
Uh-huh.
And you can, and not to bring up a sad subject, but Bob's funeral is still on YouTube. And I wrote a letter to Bob that was shown during the funeral, and it went live. It was a live stream because it was towards the end of COVID, and a lot of people just, you know, it was all about COVID at the time. But Chris's voiceover did my letter to Bob. So if you get a chance to go to YouTube to see Bob's funeral, and Christian Bale is talking, and he was a student of ours. I mean, we just had, it was a phenomenal funeral service, but Red Guitar's Chris did the voiceover for me. I love that man's voice.
Interesting. Now, yeah. You mentioned Christian Bale. Somewhere I was reading, I know, and we'll get into some of the celebrities that Bob instructed, and to this day I regret not having had the opportunity to go, because we always talked about this. He says, come on down to the track, and I'll take you around. Come on down to the track, and unfortunately, I was,
yeah.
you know how it goes when you're working at Scottsdale, too much stuff going on. But anyway, so Christian Bale, who played was in the movie Ford versus Ferrari, he was a student, but was there at some point in time, I'm not sure if I read the timeline right, but were they working on producing that movie, and Bob was kind of like instructing, because he was talking about Ken Miles. I mean, it was a real interesting article. I'm going to let you tell it, because you can tell it better than I can.
Bob's first movie that he was the technical advisor in was the movie Grand Prix. He raced in it, he did the stunt driving in it, and he trained all the actors to drive.
Okay.
So as a result, he also did... He trained Tom Cruise for Days of Thunder. He trained Nicolas Cage. He trained Clint Eastwood. He trained, you know, he's all these movie stars. And so, of course, the studios looked to Bob and said, hey, we've got a Ford versus Ferrari movie coming up, and we're going to send Christian Bale, and they were going to send Matt Damon, but he was over in France at the Cannes Festival, so he did not make it. But Christian Bale wanted to know every mannerism he could possibly learn about Ken Miles, and who better than his best friend, Bob Bondurant. Mm. They were the two Shelby test drivers. That was it. Shelby had two test drivers, Bob Bondurant and Ken Miles. And so Christian got to learn all these mannerisms of Ken Miles, and Bob trained Christian for the 5 days he was there, along with our instructors. But every day we had lunch with Christian, and it was fantastic. And those two, you know, Bob told Christian, he said, of all the people that I've trained, you have such an inept, natural ability to race. He goes, I really believe you missed your calling. And Christian said, well, Bob, I did race motorcycles. And that's all you had to say to Bob Bondurant, because that's how he started.
Yes.
Yep. So those two talked about motorcycles forever, but every day we spent hours and hours with Christian. It was the best 5 days, and much to our chagrin, Ford versus Ferrari is a great racing movie, but it's got about a dime's worth of truth of the actual facts in it.
Well,
I'm
yeah.
Just going to say it. Just going to put it out there. But that's why Bob made me promise I would write his book and tell the truth about what really happened out there. And it was some pretty... They say truth is stranger than fiction. I guarantee you when you read Bob's book, you're just going to go, wow. You have no idea how famous this guy was. Most people in America knows Bob from the school. The Europeans only know Bob as beating Ferrari for the world and then racing Formula One for Ferrari. That's what the Europeans know. The Americans are like, yeah, he's got a famous race school, but no, this man is deep waters.
You know, it's also worth noting, too, that Bob coached and got Paul Newman involved, as well
yep.
as Robert Wagner, and also was involved, I guess, in helping him with the movie Winning, which featured both those gentlemen.
Paul Newman and Robert Wagner were Bob's third and fourth students after Bob opened the school. Can you believe that? In 1968, those were his third and fourth students. He and Paul Newman became friends until 3 days before Paul Newman passed away. He was still calling Bob his last breath.
Wow.
Those two were so incredibly close, as was Bob and James Garner. And, you know, they respected each other's celebrityness, and they remained extremely close friends. I got to meet James Garner about 6 months before he passed. And my God, the stories he had about he and Bob were amazing. And he just said, Pat, after he learned mine and Bob's love story, which is a show for another day, he said, I wish I could direct this movie. And then he was gone 6 months later, but he was in kind of declining health at the time anyway. But what a compliment, right?
Absolutely. Well, now, Bob, I don't know if he raced with James Garner, but he did race for him, right? He was part of his team at one point?
Okay. So Bob trained James Garner for the movie Grand Prix.
Right.
Then they formed a race team, American Racers, together.
Okay.
Now, in the meantime, Bob is running the school and racing still in the Can-Am series. So
okay.
Now he and James have started a racing team. Bob won the first Baja 500 and talked James into going after it the following year. So a lot of people don't know, Bob didn't just race fast race cars. I mean, that guy was out there. I'll just use one of my brother's terms. When you're doing the Baja, it's balls to the wall.
Okay, yes.
And he won. And he got James into that. But what happened was then Bob had the 150-mile-an-hour steering arm broke at Watkins Glen in his McLaren, and that ended his racing days for a while. And it obviously kind of messed up him and James going forward with the racing team. So Bob ended up selling his portion of it, and... You know, it is what it is. But another little trivia, at Watkins Glen, when Bob had the accident, he was pronounced dead at the scene of the accident. And he said in the hospital, that's when he had a conversation with God. And God told him, hey, thousands of people are dying every single day on the highways. I'm going to send you back because I need you to train the world how to be better drivers. And Bob said that's all he remembers. He doesn't remember much else. And he said he's in traction from head to toe. And he tells the nurse, I need a yellow columnar pad. I'm going to do a school. And that's how that school got started. He opened the school still in one cast.
Wow.
Yeah. With James Garner by his side. James Garner was the master of ceremonies.
Huh.
The day of opening. How cool is that for a friend?
Eventually, I know he was in Sonoma for a while before they moved to Arizona. Where did the school actually start? Well, it wasn't actually
Sonoma. He originally started at the airport there in Orange County.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so they had a drag strip and they had a return road. And that's where he had the very first school.
Interesting.
And there was no place to park the cars, so we had to keep them in a storage unit like 7 miles away. So can you imagine going down the interstate every day with open wheels and 240Zs? And he had 4 Porsches in the very beginning of his first school.
Oh, no kidding. I was just going to ask you what kind of cars they were. So they're Porsches, Datsuns, and open wheel cars.
He started off with Mr. Kadayama, and he brought the Datsun 240Z to America and made them extremely popular. I did get to talk to Mr. K many times before he passed. And, oh, my God, did he love Bob Bondurant. He said, you know, me being the president of a company that was making Japanese cars, and it was still very fresh on Americans that they hated the Japanese. And he said they'd bring the 240Zs from the factory to get to Bob's school, and people were shooting bullets.
Oh.
In the cars on the flatbeds. I mean, it was intense. And for the world champion to choose the Datsun, Mr. K said, you have no idea what an honor that was. So we had the 510 Datsuns, the 240Zs, the 2000s, the little convertibles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he had 4 Porsches in there. He had the 911s and the 918s.
Oh.
Their very first Porsche driving school.
No kidding.
Yeah, and then Porsche flew Bob over to Germany to train their guys how to become instructors. And that's how the whole Porsche thing started.
Interesting. Well, now, is there... talk a little bit about Bob and Ferrari, because I don't know that part of the story. I mean, I know the Shelby side of it pretty heavy, being a Shelby
cool.
guy, obviously.
Very cool story.
But talk about the Ferrari side of Bob Bondurant.
Let's go back, because in 64, you know, Enzo called the last race so that the Americans couldn't take the world in 64. I don't know if you know that
Yep, he called off Monza.
He called the race at Monza, and it was very bittersweet, but he got to see a young American driver named Bob Bondurant, because Bob Bondurant personally drove the last 7 hours of Le Mans by himself. Dan Gurney had collapsed few minutes into his 2.5 hour stint, so Bob literally won Le Mans GT class for Carroll Shelby in 1964, the last 7 hours of that race by himself. Can you believe that? So Enzo sees this guy. Now Bob has beaten all of his 7-time world champion hill climb racers, and this is a California hot rodder who's up in the mountains of Germany. Hitler's hideout is one of the mountains they climbed up at Stuttgart. No, this is very... Bob said he just gave him goosebumps every time he went up that mountain. But, you know, so he's watching this guy, Bob Bondurant. And then the next year, Bob won every single race he was in Europe. And Enzo Ferrari... And I did talk to some of the other Formula One drivers, John Surtees in particular, who said Enzo Ferrari's nickname for Bob Bondurant was this. He said, we would get beaten, Enzo would scream and yell and throw things at us until 65. And he said he would come up to the guys and jingle the change and the keys in his pocket, in his suit pocket, and he would say, so... how did Bondurante Sir Cobra beat you today in Italian? And Surtees says, Pat, I would rather have had a muffler be cracked about on my back than have him ask me that race after race after race. So Enzo fell in love with the American driver, Bob Bondurant. And the last, yep, and so the last race, Bob wins the world, can't be denied, beats Ferrari. Bob, at the same time, was racing Formula 2. It's the last Grand Prix of the season. Bob's already won the world. Bob's in the Formula 2, and he's invited to race in a half-assed car, the BRE, for an independent team owner who needed a driver. Bob jumps in, and he beats the Italian Formula 2 driver at Monza, the pre-race before the Grand Prix.
Oh, wow.
Well, Eugenio Dragoni was the manager for the race team at the time. He goes to Bob and says, the Commendatore would like for you to be at Modena tomorrow morning to be fitted for your Formula One car. So Bob calls up Shelby and says, Shelby, remember what I told you in 1961 when we watched our first Formula One race together? I said, I am going to race for Ferrari. He calls Shelby up. Bob's in Italy, and he says, what do I do? Because Bob and Ken Miles had been testing the GT40 Mark II. And Shelby says, Bob, it's your dream. Enzo does not hire very many Americans. It's very rare. It's an honor for you to be hired by him. It's your dream. I'm going to tell you to go for it, but we're going to beat you. So now, had the people who made the movie just asked Bob Bondurant one frickin' question, just any input to the movie, of which they did not, it's Le Mans 66. Bob Bondurant's in a Ferrari. His best friend, Ken Miles, is in the Mark II that they both tested. Bob comes up next, side by side, to the GT40, to Ken Miles, and they salute each other, two-fingered salute to each other through the window, and Bob passes him. Then the Ferrari went DNF. All the Ferraris did not finish that Le Mans. They were all out within, I think, 6 hours. So it wasn't like the Ford GT beat the Ferraris that year. Ferraris all did not finish, and of course now it's a race with the GT40s racing each other. Bob, the whole team packed up, and Bob goes, where do you think Bob went?
Back to Carroll Shelby.
Went to Carroll Shelby's pit and held Ken Miles' hand through the whole race to the bitter end. And in the book, I will tell you the real story about what happened with Ken Miles and Bob Bondurant that day at Le Mans as best friends.
Well, that's
interesting. It's not what the movie has, and it's not what the book Go Like Hell says. It is a very, very poignant, emotional story.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, so Enzo Ferrari. Bob loved Enzo. He didn't get a lot of opportunity in the cars, but this is a great racing story right here. So John Surtees was the translator between Bob and Enzo Ferrari, and he says, Bob, do yourself a favor. Dragoni hates your guts because you're the American that beat the team last year. He hates the ground you walk on, and he is going to deny you cars. So put a line in your contract that says, if Ferrari does not provide me a car, I can race any manufacturer of my choosing. Enzo, not ever dreaming that was going to be a problem, signs the contract.
Wow.
Shows up. It's time for the Formula One race at Monza. Bob has out-qualified all the other drivers, and at the very end of the last qualifying, he hits four corners of the Ferrari, and now his car, he can't race. He calls up Hushka von Hinstein, the team manager for Porsche. Says, hey, remember when you offered me a seat in the Porsche? He goes, yeah. He goes, I won at Nürburgring. I think I can win for your Porsche. Bob Bondurant goes to the Nürburgring, never sat in a Porsche prototype in his life, did a couple of practice laps, qualifies on the pole in a Porsche prototype. All of his Ferrari teammates looking at him like, what the hell are you doing? And he said, my contract says I can race anything. Bob wins the race. The message gets back to Enzo. Enzo finds out Dragoni did not provide Bob a Formula One car for that weekend. This came on a tour that Bob and I were given by Piero Ferrari. We were told that there was a dent in the ceiling of Enzo's office, and it was because he was holding a Ferrari part when the news came in that Bob Bondurant was put in a Porsche prototype and beat the entire Ferrari team. And he was so angry that he threw that part and it left a dent in the ceiling. And the story goes that Ferrari would not allow anyone to fix that ceiling because he wanted it to be a reminder of how angry he got from that one incident.
Wow.
And this book is full of these stories. I'm telling you, it's amazing.
Pat, we have a few minutes left. Well, a minute or so left. So you have loads and loads of stories, and Bob's fascinating. You're fascinating. You want to come back next week and let's do part two with Pat Bondurant?
Let's do part two.
Okay. So if people want to find out more about you and Bob Bondurant, how do they go about doing that?
You know, I'm not been very good with that. I have a little teeny tiny Instagram, The Real Pat Bondurant, because people were stealing my name. There's a little bit there. I've got some snippets, fun snippets of Bob in the GT350R days when he was the test driver for that. Everybody thinks it was Ken Miles. It was Bob Bondurant. It's some lighthearted stuff, but you might want to... It's there. You know, in the meantime, wait for the book.
Okay. Well, all right. So then, so...
And I have a website. I don't look at it because I'm waiting for the economy to get better before I select what track I'm taking the Bondurant School to and bringing it back. I'm waiting to see how the elections go to get the health of the economy because it has not been favorable for me opening up the Bondurant Racing School anywhere at this moment.
Okay, well, that's fine. And then one thing I want to get into is, like, you know, because typically Ken Miles has always been associated with the Cobra, and he did a lot of stuff with the GT350, the early cars. But like you said, they omitted that. I mean, and going back to the movie, you know, and I never saw the, I haven't seen the document, or maybe I did. I'm not sure. There's a documentary on the Ford versus Ferrari thing, which I don't know much about that one either. But we can get into that next week too, talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
And that way I can do a little research a little bit, and then I'm definitely going to watch the funeral on YouTube.
Oh my gosh, you got to watch it. It'll make you cry. Bring some tissue.
No, I mean, yeah, and here's the other thing I want to share with everybody, and you can concur with this, and then I think we got about 20 seconds left. But Bob was extremely humble. Every time I met him at a Shelby meet, or I would see him at Amelia Island quite frequently, I sat with lunch with him one time, and they had at that time, this is many, many years ago, the judges had their own little area, and then the media people had our own. When we walked in there, the one guy says, hey, you know, Robert can't go in there because he's media and you're judges and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and they were getting steak and lobster and all that stuff. We were getting, you know, potato chips and ham sandwiches or something. And Bob goes, no, this gentleman's with me. He's with me. So we sat there out there on the patio.
Wow.
And I sat there for
an hour.
Such
a Bob story.
Yeah, but, I mean, such a pleasant guy and just so...
Epitome of a gentleman.
That's it.
From the moment that man woke up till the moment we went to sleep at night, he was a gentleman through and through.
On that note, Pat... Thank you for hanging out with us this week. We will have you on next week. And
my pleasure.
You have a great time. Thank you very much. I want to thank my very special guest and good friend, Pat Bondurant. I don't like to use the word widow but I mean, you know, she's the other half of Bondurant Racing. But I'm thrilled to have had her on the show this evening. And we'll have her on next week. And she's got some great stories. In the meantime, I want all my listeners to tune in every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network. Get out there. Drive your cars. Have some fun. Don't forget Festivals of Speed this weekend at the World Equestrian Center on Saturday. In the meantime, stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Francine strengthens into a Category 1 hurricane with 75-mile-per-hour winds. Louisiana is preparing for the storm to make landfall late tomorrow afternoon or evening. Tim Kerner Jr. is the mayor of Jean Lafitte, Louisiana.
Right now, we're preparing for the strongest possible hurricane that it could do with Category 2, strong Category 2.